Thanks for downloading this podcast, which is for personal use only. All contents are copyright Radio Show Limited and must not be reproduced, rebroadcast, or used in any form without permission. For contact details, go to www.radiolemon.com.
Well, hello everybody and welcome to another one of our Inside programmes. This is John Hindorf in the beautiful early summer sunshine in right in the heart of England, actually. I'm up at Hinckley and that can only mean one thing for anyone who has any kind of petrol running through their veins. I'm at the home of British motorcycle manufacturer Triumph.
This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com. The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers.
And standing outside this beautiful building with black glass front, ready to go inside and find out all about Triumph. And I am met by who, sir?
My name is Peter Clark and I work for the UK subsidiary looking after all the technical support for the dealer network.
Well, just before we go in, first of all, this is one of two facilities that you have within about half a mile of here in Hinckley. Been here for about how long?
This site here has been since the year 2000, but the factory one, just under a mile away, it was built originally in the late 80s, started production in 1991. Unfortunately, we had the fire there in the year 2002, but the place was rebuilt within 6 months and we were back into full production again.
Wow, amazing, amazing stuff. And the story of Triumph is quite amazing. Of course, originally it would have been down the road at Meriden, again, not so very far away. That is really the dead centre of the UK. Very modern looking building. How much of the manufacture goes on in here then?
We produce around about 60% of the motorcycle in-house. Whilst we don't do castings here in the UK, we do have casting facilities in Thailand, but we also use local manufacturers in Birmingham to do crankcase castings and cylinder heads, things like that for us here. And we produce around about 95 bikes a day here. Yeah. Around 103 to 104 bikes a day over in the Thailand facilities.
I'm loath to step out of this beautiful weather, but we've got work to do. Come on, take me through. We'll go in through reception. And as you might imagine, there's various displays in here. I'm immediately taken by the new Tiger Explorer there. Morning.
Morning.
Morning, ladies. Now, where are we going to go first then? I mean, that's a pretty standard looking reception area there. And we head off straight into the back of the factory.
Well, where we're going into now is the main production storage area. This is where we will store the completed bikes when they come off the assembly line.
And this is fantastic. It's like the world's biggest toy shop. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 high. And I can't begin to even count how many there are down this, effectively all down one side of the factory unit, all for the most part packaged up in their transport packaging, ready to go where?
All over the world, basically. We will build bikes here for the UK and as far away as Brazil and Australia, New Zealand. So we can actually store close to 4,000 bikes here. Wow. At any time. What we do is we plan our build so that we can get a large storage of bikes and then slow down on the build during the summer months whilst those bikes are distributed to all the markets. That gives us time to do updates on the models on the production line so that we can speed up the production through the winter months. So we do it as a seasonal build.
Motorcycling, whatever anybody thinks, people think much more about change. I'm the odd one. I'm the guy who buys his bike in October, November and December and starts getting the 500 miles on it during the winter straight away. But I realise that I'm the exception and not the rule. We're actually coming behind the scenes today at Triumph in a very special visit because we've been taken behind the scenes when, in fact, the factory isn't open for anything at the moment. So we're really going behind the velvet rope. So around about, as you say, 4,000. You wouldn't miss one if I just sort of potted off with one of those, would you?
Yeah, you'd have a hard job getting it past security.
Take me on through and let's see what's going on. So We'll head on through here. Thank you very much.
Right, where we'll go now is mainly through the main production stores, and then we'll go into the machine shops so we can see where we machine crankcases, cylinder heads, crankshafts, camshafts, all these sort of items. It's a pity you haven't got a camera with you, so you could show all the listeners what a cathedral of manufacturing we have here.
I'm looking forward to it. I love coming into manufacturing facility. Oh my goodness, now I can see all the racks that you were talking about. I raised an eyebrow when you said 4,000. I was thinking there's never going to be 4,000 there, but they're, 11, 12 racks deep here. That is a lot of motorcycles and a lot of spares. In terms of the manufacturing process itself, so everything comes into this factory, do you build up a stockpile depending on how your production is going?
It depends on what models we're producing. We actually work on a lot, like a lot of other auto manufacturers, the items turning up just in time for manufacture. That is the most cost-effective way of doing it. We have three main supply or delivery systems that we use for the assembly line. One that we use for the most expensive components, basically, and these are the items that of high value. And as we build the bikes in a sequence, and there's a mixture of models on the assembly line at all times,
really?
Rather than block building batches of 30 or 40,
right.
You will see on the assembly line, even though it's not running, that there's different models following each other. So most expensive items go out in the sequence of being built. We then do block feeds of things like cables and brake lines and tyres and things like that. And then we'd use the Kanban system, essentially, of supplying all the fasteners and these sort of consumable items to the assembly line. So that's done during the day. So there's a constant flow of parts to the assembly line during that time.
Very clever. We're inside. It's another one of our specials. We've come to the home of British motorcycle manufacturer, to Hinkley and to Triumph.
This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
Well, we've moved through in another area of Triumph motorcycle manufacturing here in Hinkley, and I'm starting to see something that I recognise as an assembly area here, with various different components off to our left, the subframes, and there's bits and pieces of wheel carriers and things like that. Pete, where are we now?
We've actually moved into the machine shops now, which is one of two. We also are actually stood next to our weld development area at the moment.
All right.
So this is where we work on the new frame construction, and the assembly processes. We build the very first ones here for the design team to use, and then any other welding that we need done in the factory, this is where it's done.
So just through here then?
Just through there.
Can I go through there?
We can just have a quick nose
through. The beauty being radio, that if there's anything secret, I won't know what it is and you won't be able to see it. So, I mean, this is a very, what I would call, and I mean this in no detriment at all, this is a very traditional machine shop, isn't it?
It is, and you'll also notice we've also got the normal machines here where our production engineers will do machining of prototype components as well. So
yeah.
We will start from a scratch piece of metal, a block of billet aluminium or steel, and we will machine out the very first components that are going to be used for assembly.
That's clearly a massive advantage that you have, been able to do that here on site, not only for the prototyping process, but also if you have to make changes or evolutions during the manufacturing process, because it's cutting down the time and it's actually physically here.
That's right. We've got immense flexibility here. We've got probably one of the largest R&D departments in the industry. We have about 260 people working in R&D now, and this is from our designers right through to the workshop technicians in the development workshop and our test riders. I mean, our test riders, they can run anything up to 90-odd thousand miles a year in distance testing. So whilst it sometimes may seem a glamorous job, you've got to have an iron butt to do it.
Yeah. And is that literally road testing? So out there on the roads of the UK, Europe, wherever else in the world, rather than being on a test track?
We use test tracks as well. We're fortunate, we have Myra just down the road from us here, yeah. Where we use a test facility. We have a permanent garage there. We have facilities out in Spain as well. One of our test riders out there is also a development engineer,
yes.
Dave Lopez. And we also use the main roads around the factory and other circuits when they become available to us.
Roughly speaking, and without giving any secrets away, what is the development cycle of a new motorcycle then. In the car industry, they tend to be working 3, 4, 5 years ahead at the absolute minimum.
Yeah, we're similar. We will take anything up to 5 years to develop a new model. In that time, we will do our, what, 3 stages of build before we go into volume production. And these are so we can prove off the main components. So we'll start off with the main design on the drawing, then we will make the puck using the plasticine, then we will start using pre-production components. We'll do several test builds on the assembly line just to make sure that the guys have got the sequence of assembly correct.
Wow.
And then normally within that 5th year, that's when we start our volume production.
Okay. Lead on. I'll chase. I find this fascinating, and in some ways, actually, I quite like the fact that we've got the place to ourselves at the moment. Because although obviously we've got the radio on, and there's still people working around here, it's not like we've got to be careful of things moving around. And see, just bits of motorbike hanging about, crankshaft just over here, yeah, to our left. Now that says V-series cranks then, yeah, so I don't have to be an engineer to identify that one.
Yeah, this is the crankshaft off the new 1215 engine that is used in the new Explorer and the Trophy engine. These are actually a forged item. They're actually manufactured for us in Spain, but as a blank, and then sent here, and then we machine them from start to finish.
Oh, really?
And we also use plasma nitrate in to harden them as well. And the process for developing or manufacturing a crankshaft is around about 25 to 26 hours. And the main reason for that is the plasma nitrate in process is what takes the time, because you have to heat them up slowly and cool them down slowly so that the hardening process is effective.
We've got used over the years in motorsport, in automotive, to reliability levels being just through the roof from what they were 10, 15, certainly 20 years ago. The kind of engineering that we're talking about and that kind of process you're talking about in terms of finishing and hardening these crankshafts, I mean, that would not have been thought about even in the relatively recent past.
That's true, but it's this process as we've been using here since we started production in 91.
Wow.
So a lot of the processes are used whilst they're being developed further to improve reliability. They've been industry standard processes that have been around for a few years now.
We tend to think of motorcycles, for a lot of us, as being not exactly a luxury item, but there are fewer and fewer people who use them as everyday transport. But quite clearly what you're engineering here is something that could clock up a heck of a lot of miles without having any issues.
That's right, and we have had examples of customers' bikes returned to us with 200,000 miles plus on the clocks, and we've stripped them down and they've still been within manufacturing tolerance at the end of that time.
Oh, weird.
Of course, the secret to it is maintenance and oil changes. Yeah. That is the secret to longevity at the end of the day.
So my little three-cylinder Thunderbird from 97 or 98, with about 5,000 miles on, it's got a bit of life in it yet.
Oh, certainly has, yeah.
Lead on. This is great stuff. Love it. If you've just joined us, we're at Triumph, and we're having a look behind the scenes in another one of our inside programmes. I'm struck by how much you have stored here at the moment. Now, clearly, as you mentioned earlier on, it's that time of year when you're beginning to clear everything out. I'm guessing that during the winter there wouldn't be as many finished items here.
No, there wouldn't be, because obviously, as you understand, there's a constant turnover of components and motorcycles as well. When you're manufacturing 50,000 bikes a year, 4,000 is a drop in the ocean in your storage area. But that's constantly being turned over. Yes. So as a space empties in the racking, another one goes in, essentially.
So just off to the left here, we've got some semi-completed machines. Let's just have a quick look down here. A lot of them in that very pretty metallic grey that I like at the moment. So these are recognisably motorcycles, and they're not far off being finished here, Pete.
Yeah, that's right. These are a line of Explorers here getting ready for final dispatch. So there'll be the final quality checks and make sure that all the components that need to go with the bike when it's dispatched to the dealer are there for them to complete the PDI, things like batteries, seats, screens. These are items we don't put on the bike on the assembly line. They're fitted by the dealer before delivering to the customer.
That's a good point, actually, because if you're listening to this and you aren't a motorcyclist, have never bought a new motorcycle in particular, and you just buy a car, you turn up with your dealer, you pull your car, you see cars getting delivered all the time, and they're pretty much ready to go. They need degreaser, the PDI, check all your fluids you send out. Now, that's not the case with pretty much every motorcycle that you'll go to your dealer. It'll arrive in a state of undress, won't it?
It certainly will, yeah. I mean, you'll think, oh, this is an incomplete bike, but by the time the customer turns up to hand over the last payment, the bike is there ready to go. The dealer will do anywhere between a half an hour and an hour turnover to the customer, explain them all the features of the motorcycle, the best way to maintain it and keep it in a prestige condition. And that's part of the process, the buying process.
And in that respect then, does that mean that obviously your end dealer, that the interface with your customer is always going to be important, whichever part of the automotive industry. But with motorcycle dealers in particular, the quality control that they've got to have for the final assembly, putting the bike together, sometimes putting on items of bodywork, as you've mentioned, then they're absolutely representing the brand, aren't they?
They certainly are, yeah. And the beauty of it is, as well, is all the dealer technicians, they come to here, the factory, for training. And we, whilst we go through the main diagnostics on engine build and EFI systems, we'll also instill in them the quality that we have here, and we want to instill that into them, and they happily take that on board because they're proud of working on our bikes.
If I just look at the build sheet here on this bike, let's see what it is. Now, can we tell where this is going? I'm looking at RPM there because they've all got digital dashboards. So, but that, I think that looks like it might be a British bike actually. I mean, coming to the UK, and the expert has a quick look. Yeah, hard to say. It's a Tiger Explorer.
Yeah, it will be on the... this is a UK bike.
Yeah, thought, excellent. That's that colour that I really like, yeah. Actually. But as you say, how much difference is there in specification? Because obviously for cars, there's often quite a bit of different left and right-hand drive, obviously, for one thing, for our American listeners and listeners in Europe. Motorcycles, there wouldn't, at first glance, seem to be that much that needs to be changed for different markets.
Not nowadays. With the new digital instruments, what we can do now is we can make them so that you can change from MPH to KPH.
Yeah.
And we're also now, we build a bike just for Europe. So rather than having a left or right-hand dip headlight, we have a symmetrical dip headlight now, which can be used on all markets.
Nice.
So essentially, once a bike is built, we don't necessarily have to dedicate it to a particular model. If an order comes in for a bike, all we need to do is put the right language handbook with the bike and send it off to that market.
And in terms of and then it's off on its way and it finds. But it seems you do build bikes for stock, because a lot of the automotive industry now don't do that. They build cars to order.
Yes, that's right. We obviously, when a new model is introduced, you will start off with a waiting list. You will have people that quite often will speculatively put a deposit on a bike that they think that they may be coming, and then once the bike is built, that bike will be built to their order. Obviously, after about the first probably 3, 4, maybe 6 months, we've dealt with all the back orders, and we're now supplying to stock for the dealer network, essentially.
Okay. Again, I recognise a lot of this area as being, again, traditional, and there's clearly some metalwork going on in this area to our left.
That's right. This, where we're coming into now, is Machine Shop 2. This is where we do cylinder heads and crankcases for the 1200 engine, also the Rocket 3s, Thunderbirds, the 800s, and we also do camshafts in this area as well, and the single-sided swinging arms for the Trophy and Explorer. They come into us as a raw item, but powder coated, and then we machine them for the bearings and everything.
Of course, over the life of Triumph, since it was resurrected, just over a dozen years ago, the variety of engines, frames, has exploded, because effectively, when it first started, it was very clever, actually, walking before it ran Triumph. There was a... not a singularity of purpose, but certainly there was a lot of common components between the different motorcycles.
That's right. We used a process called modular concept, essentially, where we built one frame. There was different suspension units for different models, but we started off with the 6 models, the 2 Daytonas, the 2 Trophies, and the 2 Tridents. So they used the same engine base, be it a 4, same frame, and then wheels and everything, and that changed between models. But within a short period of time, we were then starting to develop... And of course, within 7 years of being in production, remembering there's up to a 5-year development time, we were already then onto the T595, going on to the 600 four-cylinder engine. And, of course, the Bonneville was then started development then, which we introduced in 2000.
Yeah.
So now we build 23 models, which is, going to expand over the next few years. And out of that, there is, six, seven engine bases now to work from. And that, again, is going to be increased over the next few years.
Marvellous stuff. The story of Triumph is encapsulated in this building and what we're looking at the moment. It's RadioLeMans.com, and we're inside Triumph at Hinckley in the centre of England. Well, we're very, very privileged today because we've gone behind the scenes at Triumph in Hinckley, and we're getting our own private tour. Peter's with me, and you wouldn't think of it because of the music going on, but actually it's pretty much me and him in the whole place here. We're very much on a private visit, as I say, having a look inside Triumph. Looking at, again, very recognisable parts of motorcycles here, engine castings, various bits and pieces of the sharp end, the heart of the bike.
Yes, where we're stood now is actually between two machine lines. One where you can see this display here we got with the crankcase halves of the Rocket 3 engine, and then across the aisleway is the line where we're doing the 800 crankcases, and we can also see we've got the new 675 crankcases here as well. So between these two lines, this is where we will machine up the blank cases. And this is a process, quality control, we check 1 in 10 every day.
Really?
Okay. Yeah.
And at this point, the engine is still either in parts, it hasn't actually been, it's not being assembled here before it goes onto a machine, it's still in its component parts, is it?
That's right, yeah. And again, here we've got just a makeup of a Explorer engine. So we got basically two halves of the crankcases and the cylinder head on top. And this is how the items will look just as they go into the main assembly area.
And again, lots of what we would absolutely expect to see, a variety of engineering machinery going on here. And all silent at the moment, which is a bit spooky for me seeing this. How many people work here when this was buzzing away?
Cool. Well, between the machine shops and assembly, there is, whilst it may not seem a lot, there's just over 200 people.
Is that all?
Yeah, a lot of the processes are automated, other than assembly, where, unlike a car line, we do have to do a lot by hand. But when it comes to machining, we have the skilled machinists, but they will move components from one machine to another, do visual checks, as well as the items going off to the main production inspection area, where we use computer measuring machines to check every tolerance on the machined components.
Having spoken to people around the factory and since we've become involved, and obviously I'm a Triumph enthusiast, I've got an old one of the older bikes myself, I do get the feeling that there's a real family spirit to this and a real sense of belonging. I'm just looking around here and seeing how some of the workplaces are not sterile. There's pictures of the bikes up, there's a bit of memorabilia. Even at the guardhouse the gatehouse when I checked in this morning, there was a, first of all at the wrong place in fairness, there was a Triumph 100 years shield up on the wall. Everybody seems to be very proud to be a part of what's going on here.
They are. We have a lot of people who've worked here for 15 to 20 years now. We also have had quite a few apprentices that started off at the very beginning in the early 90s, and they've now moved up to be team leaders or even supervisors in assembly. So it is not quite, I would say, a job for life, but we have a lot of people who have been here from day one.
Yeah. No such thing as a job for life now, I'm afraid. So we're here at Triumph having a look at how the variety of motorcycles that Triumph produce for markets all the way around the world, this fantastic success story, which is not just part of UK manufacturing. This is motorcycle folklore that we're in at the moment. And of course, a lot of what happens here is exported all over the world. And to that end, There is an elephant in the room here with Triumph, because Triumph don't just manufacture here. We've talked about the overseas facilities that Triumph have. An essential part of the expansion and the globalisation of automotive industry?
It certainly is. It gives us an opportunity to sell into markets that would really be close to us, basically because of the fact of the import duties that would be levied upon these, what are essentially luxury items. But by producing them in those markets and having the factories there, it means that we can sell on the same level playing ground as the home manufacturers in that part of the world. And that's the reason why we've moved production out there.
Now, clearly it's not all production. It is production that tends to be for the area of the world it's in, and we talked about that earlier. It's the Far East. And, you know, there's a reason, as we've said, there is a reason for that. How do you ensure that the quality of machinery that is turned out of that factory is no different to what is turned out here? And how do you ensure that the, if you like, that belief that we talked about in the product by everybody who works here is replicated when you take it somewhere else? Because, you know, there's a pride about it being an English thing here. Does that work abroad as well?
It certainly does. And one of the main reasons we've been able to achieve that is we've had a lot of volunteers from the staff that work here at Hinckley have gone over to Thailand, and they're now in charge of the production lines over there. So they instill the level of quality that we have here in the UK in those facilities there. And you will have a hell of a different... You will have a hell of a trouble telling the difference between the two bikes, one built in one facility and one built in the other. There would just be no difference whatsoever.
Yeah, that's really interesting, of course, really important for continuity of product. We've moved, as you can probably hear, into a very different area. The engine assembly is on our left here. There's a quality area in front of us, quite clearly a test area, and some more near completed or completed bikes just over there behind me. Little bit of a different part of the building here, different atmosphere. So I've described what's going on here. What else am I seeing in front of me?
Well, basically, where we are now is the main engine assembly line here at Hinckley.
Oh, okay.
And this is where we will build the new 1215 engine, the Rocket engine, the Thunderbird engine, and the new 675 engine.
So that's, hang on a second, so that's a four-cylinder and a six-cylinder. You still do that big six-cylinder, don't you?
No, we don't do a six-cylinder.
Oh, right.
We only do three cylinders.
Three cylinders.
Three or twins.
Three or twins, right.
So all the twin engines are built in the factory in Thailand.
Yep.
And we build the three-cylinder engines here. Thailand also build 1050 and 800.
Yeah.
And 675 street triple engines.
Right. Okay.
But we always build new engines here at Hinckley. Because obviously we're right next door to R&D. If any problems arise during that early production period, we've got the teams on hand to resolve any issues.
And just go through the difference in capacity there for the different engines that you've talked about, because it's a big spread, isn't it?
It is. I mean, twin-wise, we have the basic Bonneville engine, which is 865.
Yeah.
And that will be with either a 360 crankshaft or a 270 crankshaft.
Okay.
That's... The 270 we use in the America and Speedmaster, the two cruisers, and we also use the same crankshaft in the Scrambler.
Okay.
In the Thunderbird, again a twin, we build that in two capacities, 16 and 1700,
right,
depending which model they're going into. We then have the
1700cc twin.
Yeah, it's
thump thump thump.
It's great. It's got some torque on it.
I like the sound of that.
That's a sports bike beaker, that one is.
Really?
Yeah, cracking engine. We then have the triple, three-cylinder 675, which we have two versions of. We have the new version, of which we now put in the new Daytona. We then have the 800 triple. We have the 1050 triple, the 1215, and, of course, our 2.3-litre rocket engine, which is the largest production motorcycle engine in the world, again is a phenomenal bit of kit.
Those big engines, those big capacities up to the 2.3, as you've mentioned, I mean, you're talking about very different engineering challenges there. Never mind putting them into a motorcycle, just the fact that they have so few cylinders and such large capacity.
That's right, yeah. I mean,
Because we're used to seeing, what I should say is we're used to seeing multi-engines, multi-cylinder engines down as, I mean, I remember 400cc four-cylinder engines in some of the Japanese bikes way back the years, little screaming things, and the engineering that was in there was akin to watchmaking. You're talking about it's a different scale here.
It is. I mean, one of the beauties of a triple is you get the power delivery of a four-cylinder engine, but you also get the torque characteristics of a twin. So whilst they may not be as powerful as the 1000cc four engines from the four big Japanese manufacturers, we're not far off it, you know, and the triple has a different characteristic which people love. I certainly love the triple engine. You cannot beat the torque delivery of that engine when you're going through the twisties.
Well, the other thing is as well, it has a unique engine note, because it's not a twin and it's not a four. There are people who will tell you all day that they love their twins. I've ridden all kinds of twins, whether they be parallel twins or horizontally opposed twins. But there's something about the triple that is just, it is different.
It is, and I try for Pro to say that it is our signature engine now. We have other manufacturers, of course, MV Agusta, they've now produced the 675, and Yamaha are going back into making triples, which they made in the 70s, and they're starting to investigate the possibilities of producing performance engines using that format.
There was a lot of people that said you couldn't, long-term, you'd never be able to sustain that triple engine because of the harmonics of the engine. It doesn't work, and comprehensively proved wrong over a decade.
That's certainly right. I mean, admittedly, we do use balanced shafts, but we make a point of dynamically balancing all the crankshafts as well as running balanced shafts. Some engines will run one, some will run two, but everything is made to such a tight tolerance nowadays, you're not far off a blueprinted engine, and we're not far off the selective assembly that used to be used to produce engines at Meriden's heyday.
Oh, really? And the kind of facilities that you have here, and the kind of operations that are going on in terms of machining the parts and then assembling them. I mean, it wouldn't have been that long ago since the kind of tolerances we're talking to would have been actually only for race engines, wouldn't it?
That's right. Yeah, and I think, in fairness, everyone has has access to that level of assembly nowadays. But that's what we're talking about now. Whereas early engines, you know, up to the 60s and 70s, weren't quite as reliable and they did require more maintenance. Of course, we don't know. We're able to extend our service period basically to the quality of oil that is available nowadays from 6 to 10,000 miles. Wow. Now, that was unheard of years ago. And even some modern motorcycles from the big four need servicing every 4,000. Again, they may not necessarily always need an oil change, but they will need a service in that time. But we've been able to build that level of quality and durability into the engine, and as I said, having good oil available to us means that we can extend these service intervals now.
The other massive step forward that's happened with motorcycles in common with the rest of the automotive industry is the advent of electronics. We touched on it with just in things like dashboards and things like that. More and more motorcycles now don't have carburetors, they have fuel injection, and again, Triumph haven't been backward in coming forward with that technology either.
No, they haven't. I mean, we initially started off using carburetors from either Cayenne or Mikuni.
Yep.
We then moved on to EFI systems in the late 90s, working with Sagem. Now we work very closely with Cayenne, so we have a development team, 50%, I think there's now 40 people working for us. Now, 20% of those will work on EFI systems for Triumph. The other 50% of it will come in at different stages in development. But we're moving on now to ride-by-wire, which means that we can integrate things like cruise control, traction control, different mapping for different weather conditions. All this sort of thing is easily available to us now, and you know, we've got some of the best EFI systems around nowadays.
And we're not just talking about performance either, because the other thing that we've all had to do is learn how to be more efficient and look after emissions. Now, we talked about bikes going into different areas of the world, and that's clearly something you've also got to think about here when you're designing a bike, when you're having the bike tuned to various different marketplaces.
That's right. We have to think, especially now when they're starting to introduce more ethanol into fuel around the world. And so we have to tailor our fuel maps and our ignition advance to those qualities of fuel that are around. So that can all be built in with a fuel map. And of course, there's a different fuel map for every gear. So all that is built into a team, which we have a brilliant team here at Hinkley that work out all our fuel maps for us. And they, again, during that development stage, will test different fuel maps, different conditions. And we will run probably the worst fuel you'll ever imagine to come across just to see what will happens. Happen.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to do that sort of experimentation.
So in terms of buying a Triumph motorcycle, the kind of technology that we have in it and the kind of attention to detail, people often think of motorcycles as a bit of a poor relation of a car. But in terms of what's in there, all the technology that you get are absolutely the equal, if not pushing the envelope.
Certainly is. There won't be a great deal of difference now between the electronics used on a motorcycle that you see in some of the top range Mercedes, Porsches, BMWs nowadays. We're at that level now, and not just us, all the industry, we're at that level now.
Does that mean that the kind of people who are working here are not just the engineer, artisan working in metal, you've also got to have electronics engineers as well?
Oh, we do, yeah. We have guys that, well, it's a black art to me, but they are great.
It's all ones and zeros, that's what they keep telling me.
That's right, ones and zeros, yeah. And they are incredible guys. I mean, we do have a process of supporting students through university where Triumph will help them. We start them off, come in here, they will spend a year with us doing all their training, and then we sponsor them through the university, and then they come back to be our development engineers. So we have a way of making sure that the people coming through in the future are dedicated to the brand.
And engineering apprenticeships as well?
That is something else we're looking into. Whilst we started off with some original sort of like basic apprentices, obviously the way tutoring and everything in that area has changed over the years, we're now looking at employing more apprentices over the coming years.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMans.com.
I'm now at the real business end of things as we're looking at the assembly line. Now, unlike a car assembly line where everything runs on the floor or on robotised dollies, everything is hung down here from an overhead track. And the first thing I notice here, Pete, is that, one, two, three bikes, four bikes there that all look like they're completely different versions of Triumphs.
That's right, yeah. As I was saying earlier, we don't block build our models. We have, and it gives the guys on the assembly line different things out during the day.
So they get a bit of variety.
That's it. That was the word I was looking for. Yeah, variety is the spice of life, as they say. And the fact that they're doing a different model each time, that actually helps to keep the quality of assembly high.
That's a good idea.
Because where you're building the same model one after another, the quality can just slide off a bit as you start getting bored with doing a particular job, because we are talking assembly here. But with this variety here, with a different model, they have to check the spec sheets every time, make sure that the right spec component is going on the bike. And as you said, we got five different models here. And if we just go a little bit further up, you see there's two other models on here as well. So
how do the guys know? I mean, well, there's a rack of exhausts here, which on this side all look the same. On the other side, there's two different variants. There's two different ones on the bottom. I mean, training clearly key here, but how do they know which components to put on which bike so that you don't get horrible bitter at the other end?
well, on the build card as well, there will be sections of it which will have a certain number on, and the guys will know that letter and number will correspond with a particular component. So as you say here, this rack next to us where the silencers are, well, we've got Explorers one side, mainly Trophy, and we've also got some Rocket and Thunderbird ones here as well. And essentially, the guys obviously get used to what goes on what bike.
Yes.
And as you were saying, training is very important here. We have teams set up on the assembly line. There will be about eight guys in the team. They will have a team leader. And the team leader will know every process. And he will have the responsibility of training all the operatives on the line. And they will cross-train between models and positions on the line.
Oh, really?
So, again, gives us flexibility during the working day. You know, people go ill one day,
yep.
but you need someone to step in, and we do have that flexibility here as well.
Is there a commonality in some of the fixing products here? Because obviously I can see there's washers, there's various bolts and bits and pieces. Presumably you don't have a different bolt for each different application.
That's right. There will be some areas of the bike which share common components with other models, and as you say, mainly fasteners. Sometimes you will need a specific fastener for a job, but yeah. In most occasions you can use a set fastener for many applications.
It makes perfect sense to me. I'm just going to move down here if you don't mind. It makes perfect sense to me, but in some ways I'm quite surprised to see it, because it actually in some ways makes the whole thing look a little bit more complicated than it is. And I mean, it's a thing of beauty, even when it's standing still here, these bikes in various stages of undress that move down the line. And is this a stop-start line then, in terms of it comes to a particular station, or will it always be moving if it was actually on production at the moment?
It would be constantly moving. Right. They run at a speed where a process time is around about 100 seconds. Right. So whilst that may not sound a lot, you can actually achieve quite a lot in 100 seconds when it comes to fitting components to a bike. Now, we also have stations that are actually away from the line that will do some sub-assemblies, which are then fed to the line. Mm-hmm. So obviously that makes the whole assembly process a little bit shorter in time.
Yes.
But a bike takes around about 5 3/4 hours to build from start to finish.
That's assembly.
That's not
the individual components.
That's not the individual components. So when an engine starts onto the chassis line, and we start to build the bike, and it rolls off and goes into the rolling road before packing, that takes just over, around about 5 3/4 hours.
And obviously, we're here at this point where the silencers is going on. There's a spec sheet above saying what goes on to which, and it's working both sides as well here?
That's right. Both sides of the bike will be worked on at the same time. There are the odd station where there'll only be one operative working, and he will move or she will move around the bike. But in most occasions, you've got someone either side of the bike working.
Now, at this point, we've already got the engine in the frame here, and we're hanging on ancillary components here, as we said, the silencers. It's round further back round the line, is it, where the engine goes into the frame?
Yeah, it actually, right at the start of the assembly line, the engine is fed to the line, and then the chassis goes onto it.
Oh, really? So that's the heart of the bike is put in right at the beginning?
It certainly is, yeah. I mean, obviously, there are certain components that have to be fitted into the chassis before the engine goes in. Things like the brake lines for ABS and the ABS modulator, they're put on in a sub-assembly area, then that frame goes onto the engine. And prior to the engine going onto the chassis line, it has already been tested.
Oh, really?
It is only a cold test, but it would have had the oil put in, it would have been leak tested to make sure there's no leaks in the combustion chamber or in the water jacket. And then it's run up using an electric motor to check the selection of the gears. And then the first time it's actually fired up is when it goes on to the rolling road.
Oh, yeah, because, if you're not au fait with motorcycles, engine and gearboxes tend to be an integral unit on motorcycles.
Yes, they are, yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we have to be so careful with the spec of oil, because whereas a car, you can use many friction modifiers, you can't in a motorcycle, because the oil is shared by the engine, the gearbox, and of course the clutch. And you don't want any friction modifiers in the clutch. You don't want to be losing grip there. So that's where the quality and the spec of oil is very important.
I'm completely impressed. And I've been down at a few lines of various different auto manufacturers down the years, and this stacks up with them. Oh, I like that bit. So just to my right here, I should tell you, for a bit further back before the bit we were talking about a moment ago, these bikes are a little bit more unfinished, if you like. They've got the engine, the gearbox, and no wheels, and the line actually drops down to a lower level, because whatever it is that's going in there, front indicators and various other things, need to be done at a different height.
That's right. Obviously, you don't want people having to reach too far or even step up to a bike. Yeah. So what we do is we lower the bike to make it at a comfortable level for the guys to work at. Health and safety is always important as well, obviously, for your workforce.
It's brilliantly simple, but of course it's something that you have to think about when you were designing the line, as well as designing the motorcycle. So just remind us again about how many motorcycles come out of here on a on a typical work day or in a particular period?
On a typical work day, it will be sort of 93, 94 bikes a day coming off the assembly line here at Hinckley. When out in Thailand, we will build around about 100, 304 a day.
Getting the sharp end of 200 bikes a day are being produced by Triumph.
That's right, yeah. And if necessary, if the demand requires it, we can up that rate as well.
Okay, can we have a little look, a little bit further round? Because I'm intrigued by following this process round now, as we've seen various components going on the bike. And here's another workstation where the bikes are looking much closer to being finished. And this says it is a this is a hold bench. What's happening here?
Well, that hold bench is actually just the other side of the line, and if we find anything wrong with a body component, that's where it's held before it goes off to be inspection or maybe repainted. But where we're actually stood now, this machine next to us is where the brake fluid goes in. And similarly, just stationed just before it is where the coolant goes in. Now, in both processes, we use what's called a vacuum backfill. So essentially, connect the machines up, a vacuum is caused in the system, no vacuum, we know there's a leak. But once the vacuum is established, we use that and a couple of bar of pressure to put the fluid into either the coolant or the brakes. And it takes around about 60 seconds to fill and bleed the brake system and similarly on the coolant system.
Oh, I need something like that. It's a bit big to put in my garage, but I need something like that at home for the old cars as well. That's brilliant stuff. 90 degree turn here, and the bike is now much more looking like a finished motorcycle. It's still got a ways to go before it rolls off the end, though.
That's right, yeah. Where we come on to now is the body line. So the bike, where it's been going around in the overhead conveyor, it gets dropped down onto its wheels and the back wheel is clamped, so the bike is held upright. And then we got substations on either side of the track building up the bodywork, and then that is then fitted to the bike before it goes to final inspection before going off to the rolling road.
Right, we'll have a little look down there where so we go down. I think we can just squeeze down it. Oh, look at all of these sitting. I'll have that one and that one and that one and that one. I mean, one of the things we were talking about is the variety of bikes that you build here. And over the years that this factory's been in operation, of course, the technology that we've mentioned in terms of the electronics on the bike, but some of the hardware has changed as well. You've got shaft drive bikes now that you've never had before.
That's right. Shaft drive was something that we'd actually sort of steered away from at the beginning. One of the thoughts there was the weight of it being a little bit of a disadvantage. But of course, now we're getting into models like the Trophy and Explorer. Customers want shaft drive for the flexibility that it gives them. And it's now becoming quite a norm, but chain is still the best way to transfer power to the back wheel.
I saw what you rode in on because I followed you in, and I know that's what you've got as well. The bikes to my left now are getting bodywork putting on them, and they're becoming now, for me, not an expert, but they are now becoming recognisable as the different models. We could tell them apart before because they had different types of componentry on them, exhaust, etc. But now they're getting the personality that you would expect to see from the shiny brochure or down in your Triumph dealer.
That's right. I mean, where we're seeing it here, for example, we've got a Thunderbird Storm.
This is this matte black one here, which is absolutely glorious. This is I do like these matte paints that have become all in fashion recently.
That's right. It is something that we've been asked for by our customers, and we've introduced this colour on several models beforehand. But of course, with this model here, it is very much a boulevard cruiser, and people want that sort of look, that retro look from it, with a matte finish.
And this is matte paint. This is not a wrap. You've done it before on some of the Tigers, in fact, haven't you?
That's right. What we do here is we actually use just a base colour, but the lacquer is the matte.
Ah, that's clever.
Yeah.
So that's very clever.
Yeah. I mean, the only downside of it, of course, you can't take out any blemishes. You know, if you do get a blemish, it is a respray job, unfortunately.
Never thought about that. Because you can't really polish it, can you? That's the thing, you sort of wash it. And how do you keep it clean?
Well, it's just basic soap and water. That's all you need with these. You don't need any clever chemicals or polishes or anything. Just a basic car shampoo is all you need for this.
So this is effectively what I'm seeing here is the end of the line. We saw the start of it with the engines at the other side of this factory unit. And this is as much as this is going to get to this point, is it?
That's right. Where we are now is where we have the final inspection before the bike goes off to the rolling road. Now, what happens there is the bike will go in, we'll put a litre or so of fuel in, we run the engine up, get it up to temperature, we put the diagnostic tool on it, we make sure the EFI system is working with inside its correct parameters. We run it up to temperatures as the fan comes on, so we know that's working.
Good point. Yep.
And then once we know that the engine is where it needs to be, and it's what we call is adapted, we then put it onto the rolling road. And there we run it up to around about half the RPM that it will normally can run at. And we'll check the operation of the gearbox and the brakes and ABS as well, because we have to make sure the ABS is working correctly. And then when the bike comes off, there'll be a printed readout of what the bike has achieved on that line.
It's something that you never think of, but I'm looking at this matte black machine here, which I really like, the Storm. It's got its keys in it. Of course it has. It would have to have its keys with it as it comes down through the line, but it's daft little things like that that until you see it, you don't think about
it. Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, each lock set is individual to each bike.
Of course,
we record that lock set. The number on it goes onto the build card, and then if a customer, unfortunately, loses their keys, a quick phone call to the factory, we can supply them with a key number and they can have the new keys cut.
We're at Triumph. You're inside on RadioLeMans.com. Well, here we are at Triumph. It's John Hindhoff. We're inside the Triumph factory at Hinckley here, right in the centre of England. And we've followed through the manufacturing process here. Off the end of the line, the bikes go into the rolling road, which is just behind me and to my right-hand side. Pete's with me. And right, these bikes have done their bit. They've been measured. They've been proved to run and do everything that they want. Again, they're not. Again, we've got to make this point. I couldn't get on that this Triumph here and jump out of it. It's got no seat, and there's one or two other things ready. Those things are done by the dealers, but to all intents and purposes, that's as much as going to be done to these, and this is the last area that they go before they're packed and sent off to their new owners.
That's right. We're now at the right at the end of the line now, and as we said, we've checked the bikes out on the rolling road, make sure they're working as they should be. And now we have final assembly before we send the bikes to the packing truck. That's where some other, the last components will actually meet the bike. Things like seats, batteries, which will then be prepared by the dealer rather than being prepared here. The screens, these are all packed up in bubble wrap and everything, put into the packing case with the bike.
So even if it doesn't go on the bike, it goes with the bike?
Yeah, that's right, it does. It'll be a dry cell battery put into the bike. The acid pack will go with it, and then when the dealer gets it, he'll put the acid in and commission the battery, and then it's ready to go then just before the customer collects it.
But these are recognisable Triumph motorcycles, and again, a massive variety of what we got, the Explorer there, and again with the matte paint on that one, that looks very rough and tough, and that feels like I could tackle the Gobi Desert on that one, even as it's standing there at the minute. We've got this is a 675 Daytona.
That's right.
Yeah. That tiny little thing, and I mean, amazing, completely different looking bike. Next to that is one of the very lovely new trophies, again, shaft driven. And over here, one of the cruisers that we talked about earlier, this one in shiny black with the two bright red racing stripes, which I had to say, that really caught my eye as we walked over. That's one of the Rockets all ready to go. And again, just underlining here the variety of tasks that people are doing on each of the stations.
That's right, yeah. Again, we will have spec sheets for each model at the stations, so when the bike turns up, the guy knows exactly what process he's got to use, checking the bike from front to rear, you know, starting at the front, going to the rear on one side, going around the other side, doing exactly the same process, making sure there's no loose components, nothing missing, no flaw in the paintwork. And if anything is found that's not up to the standard that we expect, we'll put it to a side, and we have a team of guys who will do rectification. No, we don't do any repairs. If an item is damaged, it's scrapped and a new component is put on.
So if there was for example, and there isn't, and normally these strip lights would be on, but if, for example, there was a ding and there was an actual dent in that beautiful metallic black paintwork on the tank of that rocket there, you wouldn't try and knock that out. That would be taken off and a new tank would be found for that.
Yeah, exactly that. That would end up in the crusher.
Really?
Yeah, we... Being a manufacturer, we don't supply second-hand parts or anything like that. Anything that is damaged is crushed, unfortunately. Some people may think it's a little bit of a waste.
It keeps up the quality control.
That's right. You can't have a customer all of a sudden knocking the tank and a bit of filler falling out. So we make sure that they always have a brand new component fitted if we find a flaw with any part.
Triumph is such a big brand in terms of its name. It would have been easy, I suppose, for a few years ago when Triumph was in trouble, for the brand to carry on without necessarily building motorcycles. What I've got to say, Pete, is it's great to see just the variety of what's going on, the attention to detail with what's going on. This is a 21st century manufacturing process that's going on here, but producing bikes that are very recognisable as Triumphs that don't slavishly follow the heritage but are clearly mindful of it.
That's right, yeah. Whilst we will try and follow some of the old heritage, obviously with the Bonneville range, we also want to be a new modern mainstream motorcycle manufacturer. The problems, if you rely on your heritage all the time, you end up hitting a brick wall and your sales drop off. Our customers, and we need to, of course, attract new customers and younger guys to the brand, they will associate some of the younger guys, the Bonnevilles, with the as Triumphs. But when they see the stuff that's coming out with nowadays, like this 675 Daytona R next to us here, top of the range Brembo and all in suspension on it, you know, this is the same sort of stuff that is going to be used on the Isle of Man next week.
Yeah.
You know, it's top of the range stuff that the customers are getting hold of, you know.
Triumph's always been a brand that has attracted celebrity. You know, you think of Marlon Brando, one of my heroes, Steve McQueen, clearly. And let's not forget that jump that his stunt coordinator, Bud, did was on a Triumph that was just made to look like a BMW. Let's not forget that one in The Great Escape. They've always attracted celebrity. It's always been a brand that's had a certain cachet. And what I see here is none of that's been lost. None of that's been lost at all, but what you're doing is effectively producing a greater variety of bikes to appeal to a wider selection of customers, and motorcycling needs that, not just Triumph. Motorcycling needs that, don't it?
It does, yeah. And there are a lot of celebrities now still, you know, guys from Jay Leno right through to Rufus Hound. You know, these are guys that love ours. We just Alfie Bow, the opera singer, he's just had a news speed triple from us. You know, these are guys that they love their motorcycles and they want to be associated with a successful brand. And you know, just like all the European manufacturers, we have that little bit of extra, as the French would say, je ne sais quoi. You know, we are what people look into. You know, there are people that want the fashion side of it as well as what the bike is capable of doing, you know. And that attracts all sorts of people to the brand.
I've got to be honest, I think if you're a motorcycle enthusiast, if you have to ride a motorcycle every day, and some people still do, thank goodness, I choose to ride a motorcycle because sometimes it's more convenient and I enjoy it. But I think if you're a motorcycle enthusiast and you're going to have more than one, it's a bit like if you have guitars, then you've got to have a Fender Stratocaster and you've got to have a Gibson Les Paul. Well, I think if you've got more than one motorcycle, one of them's got to be a Triumph. I think there's almost got to be a law for that.
That's right, yeah. It's amazing, and it still, in this day and age, it really amazes me how many people not only have several motorcycles, or they're fortunate to have several motorcycles in their garage, but we also have a lot of our customers. When they've bought one bike, when a new model comes out, they'll buy that one without selling the other one. And they'll have 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 bikes in their garage, and they'll all be Triumphs, you know. And you can't beat loyalty like that.
No, you can't. Great stuff. Thank you very much for showing me around. I've thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed what I've learned today. And hopefully you who are listening have learned a little bit too, as we've been inside a Triumph here in Hinckley. Well, thanks very much to Peter Clark, who's showed me around for this special inside on Triumph here at Hinckley, and an exclusive visit for us, the only people in the factory. Never thought I'd hear myself saying that. And, you know, I'm left with the unmistakable impression that Triumph as a brand is in very good hands, and in, frankly, in rude health, which is even a better thing to say. The balance between technology and heritage is something that is often difficult to achieve, and yet Triumph seem to have mixed that cocktail to absolute perfection. And with the promise of even more new and exciting Triumph motorcycles coming on stream in the relatively near future, it's clearly a brand that is not content on standing still and resting on its laurels, but one that is thrusting proudly forward into a new era for British motorcycle manufacture. And have no fears, we're looking, and make no mistake, we are looking at the absolute cutting edge of motorcycle manufacturing here, with the electronics, with the different variety, the complete variety of bikes that have been designed and manufactured here, right in the centre of England. And they are proudly still British built and British engineered. I accept that manufacturing sometimes even has to go on abroad, and that makes sense for global expansion, and Triumph is very much a global brand. I'm impressed at the compact nature of what I've seen today. There's everything has a purpose, and it's fitted into a relatively small space here at this factory unit that I've had a look around. And I'm also really, really pleased to say that I would be proud to ride my old 1997 Thunderbird up here back to the factory. In fact, that sounds like a day out for me as well. Hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have. It's the inside story on RadioLeMond.com of Triumph Motorcycles, proudly still conceiving, designing, building, testing and selling from right in the centre of England here at Hinckley.
The inside stories on the teams, suppliers and drivers. This is Inside on RadioLeMond.com. This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemond.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.